Very good. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out so early on a Saturday morning. I'm going to talk to you about some ongoing research that I've engaged in along with some colleagues, my colleague Scott Curtis in the geography department, Doug Gamble, who's in geography down at UNC Wilmington, and we're working with some folks down at the University of West Indies in Jamaica, especially Donna Campbell. And this is a project looking at the relationship between climate change and agriculture. So small farming in Jamaica is facing a lot of difficulties from both climate change and from a lot of economic changes. So a little bit of background. We can think about how small farmers in the Caribbean region are under stress. And they are from a lot of different angles. On the one hand, there are climate issues that small farmers are facing. IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, has suggested that the Caribbean is likely to see more variable rainfall, an intensification of storms, and a greater incidence of drought. So farmers in the Caribbean region, I think, are especially vulnerable to these kinds of things. They're small states. Sea level rise is another issue that small farmers are very interested in, or concerned about, rather, in the Caribbean region. It's not just climate, though. There's also a series of economic changes that have taken place over the last couple of decades. Agricultural policy is changing, in particular, more free trade, allowing cheaper imports, which compete with the local farmers. There are land pressures on urbanization and other kinds of development activities. And in many Caribbean states, there's a lot of rural to urban migration. As livelihoods are less viable in the countryside, people move to the cities, and then we get the concomitant problems of dramatic urban informal settlements and all the policy challenges that they provide. So the project that I've been involved in is trying to understand these two different types of stress that farmers are facing. And in the literature, this is sometimes described as a double exposure. Farmers are exposed on the one hand to climate stress and on the other hand to economic stress. And so we wanted to try to assess what this double exposure looks like for farmers in the Caribbean. Here's just a quote from the literature. O'Brien and Lychenko say, by double exposure, we refer to the fact that regions, sectors, ecosystems, and social groups will be confronted both by the impacts of climate change and the consequences of globalization, or we could think about that as economic changes. Just very briefly, for those of you that don't know much about how policy discussions are oriented around these kind of stresses and risks that are faced by small farmers, you might hear of three different kinds of terms. A lot of times we speak of the vulnerability that are faced by people in various parts of the Global South and the Caribbean, specifically for us. Vulnerability refers to the way that populations are exposed to certain kinds of stresses and how they might impact them. So there's a lot of work going on trying to measure vulnerability of small farmers in different parts of the world. People also speak of resilience, which is a slightly different concept. Resilience is more at the level of an ecosystem or a system. A lot of it comes from computer science and systems thinking, but it refers more about the ability of a system to cope with stress. And then lastly, you also hear a lot of talk about adaptation, which is how systems, local farmers, can adapt to changing circumstances and cope with the changes that they see around them, either in terms of climate or the economy. So our broad project is aimed at trying to evaluate this double exposure. What are farmers facing on the climate side and on the economic side, and how does that relate to vulnerability, resilience, or adaptation on the ground for particular farmers? So we've been, over the last couple of summers, doing some field work, and we're taking a kind of mixed methods approach. Scott and Doug are atmospheric scientists, and what they are actually engaged in is sort of collecting of data on changes in the local climate. So we're setting up rain gauges and measuring rainfall, and they're taking temperature readings and looking at soil moisture and that kind of thing. So we're gathering some scientific data. I'm the ethnographer on the team, and so my interest is actually talking to people and understanding how they perceive these changes. So we're also doing surveys and interviews with farmers and local officials in Jamaica, and we're asking farmers to fill out some of what we're calling water logs to kind of describe what are you experiencing in your local climate, how are you responding to them, are you making changes in what you do with your cropping patterns, and so on. So we're doing this in southwestern Jamaica, the parish of St. Elizabeth. This is the region where most of the country's basic vegetable and fruit crops are grown. So this is not big-scale export agriculture of sugarcane or coffee or anything like that. It's small farms. They're not highly mechanized, locally owned. Cultivation can be done year-round, so most farmers plant a succession of crops around the year. Most of this, again, is aimed at the domestic market. These are not big farms that are trying to export. It's basically for local consumption. We're looking at three areas in particular, Hounslow, Potsdam, and Flagamet, and the conditions are slightly different. These are the altitudes. Potsdam is higher up, much cooler crops. They grow there things like cabbages and carrots, whereas Flagamet and Hounslow are a bit lower. You find more things like peppers and tomatoes and sweet potatoes and a lot of other crops. Here's just some images about what it looks like. Flagamet, you can see these low-lying plains in the farm fields here. Hounslow is quite similar. Potsdam is a little bit different. That's that higher altitude area. You can see a crop of cabbages here. Cabbages wouldn't survive very well down here in the hot, dry plains of Flagamet. Hounslow, in particular, has two characteristics that are important that I'll talk about a little bit later. One is there are underground irrigation systems in Hounslow that roughly are around this area. So if you live within this gray shaded area, you have access to a sprinkler system. You can put your pipes, hook up to the underground pipes, and basically have irrigation for your farm. Presumably a pretty good thing, especially if you're facing increased drought because of climate change. And secondly, in Hounslow, there's a new packing facility. So this is a brand new processing facility, and this company is making contracts with local farmers to supply them with tomatoes and peppers. They get processed, turned into frozen vegetables that end up in the supermarket. So for some farmers, there's a new market opportunity to get involved with this kind of farming, but only certain farms, as I'll talk about a little bit later. Okay, so first thing we wanted to do, and what we've been doing over the last couple of summers, is trying to assess the double exposure. What is it that farmers are feeling stressed about? What are they facing in their day-to-day activities? So let me talk first about the climate side. And again, this is not my expertise. I can do this, I think, fairly quickly. But from interviews with farmers, they've told us three things that they're noticing. One, they say it seems to be getting warmer here in southwestern Jamaica. This is just a graph that Scott and Doug put together that shows you average temperatures. This is from readings in Montego Bay, which is quite far away from St. Elizabeth Parish, but we don't have temperature data from St. Elizabeth. So this is an indication of what might be happening in our study area as well. Temperatures generally trending upward, but it's hard to say for certain. Secondly, farmers tell us that the rainfall patterns seem to be more variable. And in particular, they say, they talk about garden rains as the kind of gentle rain that soaks the soil, is very good for crops, becoming less common. And so-called pond rains that come down in a torrent and create, you know, water, standing water on the farm fields, not very good for agriculture, becoming more common. And, you know, there's also been an increase in tropical storms. So there seem to be increased variability in the climate. So even as they say there are more heavy storms, farmers also tell us there has been an increase in localized drought, that in particular years there's not enough water to grow good crops, and that this is a concern for them. Let's zoom past that. So on the climate side, it does seem like that there are some stresses that farmers are facing. Sorry, let me zoom through this too. So what about the other side of the double exposure question? What kind of economic or social challenges are farmers facing? Again, this is primarily from doing interviews with farmers and asking them, what gives you stress as a farmer? And they also point to three different things. Number one, the cost of inputs are going up. And here I've got some quotes that I'll read to you, and I apologize in advance for my fairly poor Jamaican patois, but I'll give it my best shot. So here's a farmer that says, the problem is chemical, expensive. Fertilizer, keep on raising, regular. Seed, the seed we get coming from abroad, expensive. So it's hard for you to buy them stuff. And you put it in the ground, you end up at a loss. So everybody talked about how the price for the things that they need to be successful as a farmer keep going up. prices for farm products, not so much. Secondly, a lot of farmers complain about higglers. Higglers are basically middlemen that come by with a truck to take the product to market. A lot of these small farmers don't have a vehicle, and they're basically relying on these transporters to come by, they make an agreement, then they take their crop to the market. And in this trade-off, most farmers think that they end up losing. So here's what one farmer says. When the crop comes and you're ready to reap, the higglers then determine the price, you know. And you refuse some selling at that, then just go to the next farmer and instead. So in other words, these higglers come by and say, I'm going to give you, you know, $1 a pound for your tomatoes, take it or leave it. Tomatoes are ripe, they're going to rot if you don't get them to market, and you really have no choice but to accept what the higgler is asking. Then buy it from us cheap, and then go there and then make a markup. So when you check it out, the higglers then make more money than we. Then can buy 3-4 vehicle, big house, and we have nothing. So this is speaking about the lack of capital that farmers experience, so they can't invest in a vehicle, they can't get their crop to market, and they're at the mercy of the higglers to get their crop to the market. And then lastly, a whole lot of farmers told us that the prices fluctuate dramatically over the course of the season. Farmers talk about catching the crop, which means if you time it so that you're reaping it right when the price is high, you're going to be okay. But if the price is low, you're in big trouble. Sometimes a whole year, you're lucky enough to catch one. Lose, 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 catch one. That's the cycle. State farmer says you have to be constantly timing the market and hope that you catch it this time, which is not, he admits, a very good way to do business. So your tomatoes are ripe, you got to sell them. You just have to sell at whatever that market price is at the moment. Part of the problem is that a lot of farmers in the region are planting the same kind of thing. And so many farmers said, at certain times of the year, we get a glut. And that's when the prices are low. You see what happened now? A lot of the farmers then planting the same thing. So we come in a glut. That is the time to get cheaper. That's the time we get a beating. You plant cabbage, me have cabbage, every Dick, Tom, Harry, everybody have cabbage. So it's a glut on the market, so it's cheaper. So farmers are aware, and one of the things the Jamaican government has proposed is actually an information sharing system in which we try to say, okay, there's a bunch of farmers over there that have cabbages in the ground, maybe you should plant peppers or tomatoes so that the same crop isn't all coming due at the same time. Here's, I think, an overall statement that suggests what farmers are experiencing. Farming right now in Jamaica, 4 steps forward and 5 backward. So you cannot survive, because you have to buy the chemical at an expensive rate. When your crop comes, you don't have control over the price. The government leaves you to the mercy of the higglers. So most time, what you would like to achieve, you cannot achieve for your farm. So I think that it sort of sums up the sense of real stress that farmers feel in this area of Jamaica. So I think it's clear there is this double exposure going on. Farmers are kind of stressed by climate on the one hand, and they're stressed by market conditions on the other. Here's a nice summary. From last year, April, I couldn't catch a crop. Plant tomato, the rain come and take it. I plant cabbage, the price come and take it. Just like that. So if the rain doesn't take it, the price takes it. Either way, the farmers are not making a profit. They're really struggling in this part of Jamaica. One of the things that we want to do as we continue our work is actually to try to provide some advice to these farmers to see how they might be able to adapt to these conditions a little bit better. So that's the first part of our project, basically, is to map out this double exposure. We have a grant, an NSF grant now, to spend the next couple of summers in Jamaica talking to more farmers, talking to higglers, talking to local government officials. And there's two ways that I think we're interested in maybe disrupting or making more complex this double exposure idea. One of them is to make the point that environment and economy are not just separate things, that you have climate stress and economic stress, and you just add one to the other and it makes double. That there's actually complex interactions between the environment and market conditions. And here's a really interesting example. This is just makes the point, global social change and environmental change actually interact with each other. A lot of farmers told us that what we might look at as climate risk or stress can actually be an opportunity. And that's because when there are disastrous climate events, that's when the price can go up. So there's sometimes an inverse relationship between the growing conditions and the price that you get. So here's a couple of farmers. You have to have a drought to get a good price. A drought or a flood. And another one says, you just let nature take its course. If you get through, you'll get a price. So one interesting thing is in hurricane season in particular, farmers keep an eye on the satellite, and when they see a storm coming out in the Atlantic, they plant seedlings. They put them wherever they can put them, under their bed, in their kitchen, and if a storm hits, the minute that hurricane leaves the island, they're out there in their fields planting tomato seedlings. Why? Because 6 weeks from now, if you've got the first ripe tomato on the island, you're going to get a great price. So they're all trying to get out in the field as soon as possible. So one guy says, well, whenever you have a hurricane, that's the only time you make money out of your crop. So who survived while the rest of the perish go wash away? You understand me now, right? What he's saying is, I actually like hurricanes because I think I can outcompete my fellow farmers, get my crop in first, and get a great price once every, you know, all the other crops are destroyed by the hurricane. So there's some interesting relationships, I think, between climate and the market conditions on the one hand. And then one other thing that I think we're very interested in, which is, remember I said, in the literature people talk about vulnerability faced by farmers, the resilience of local systems, and the adaptation to changing circumstances. Well, just because we're exposed to a certain kind of climate risk or market conditions doesn't mean they affect every farmer the same. And really, in the next phase of our work, what we want to understand is what is it that mediates between the risk, the hazard, the exposure that farmers face, and whether any particular farmer on the ground is able to be successful. And one of the key things that we think is playing a really big role is what I'm calling an agricultural assemblage, or what we could just really think of as different farming systems, and in particular, water. The way that water functions in the local farm economy is really important. In case anybody's sort of aware of it or knowledgeable of it, I can tell you what I'm drawing on theoretically is something called actor network theory, which is, I think, a very influential theory within the social sciences developed by Bruno Latour and others. I have a bunch of slides on this. If you want to ask me questions, I'll be happy to talk about it. But it's more of a philosophical discussion that probably will just bore most of us in the room. So I'm going to kind of gloss over that. But let me briefly give you what we think, an indication of how different types of watering systems influence farming differently in Jamaica. So there are four different kinds of farming systems that we have identified, and the next phase of our project is going to be to compare them. So at the base level, the farmers with the least amount of technology basically hand water their crops. So you see these blue barrels out around the region. They're just rain barrels. They collect the rainwater, and then you come in and take water out of the barrel and just pour it on each individual plant in your field. Fairly low technology. As you might imagine, this kind of system puts people at risk when there's a drought. So, you know, one farmer says, if we had water then, we could do any crop. We'd be rich money. But because this farmer does not have access to water other than what comes from the sky, he's at a certain level of vulnerability in the face of any kind of climate change. Sort of stepping up a level in technology, the local or the regional government is sponsoring this black tank program, which a truck comes around and fills up the tank. Farmers have to pay for this water, but what it means is they have access, even during times of drought, and you can see the pipes come through, and basically they can water their crops through gravity. It's just a gravity system. The water filters down from the tank through the fields. So on the one hand, one of the farmers that has a tank said to us, we have a tank. We can go on until the rain starts to fall. So when there's a drought, this farmer's okay. But on the other hand, farmers also told us that the price for water has gone up like three times over the last 3 or 4 years. So this water used to be provided by the government. There are now private companies that come by with a truck and fill up your black tank. And so one farmer says, he had a tank full of water, but then the price of water went up. And he says, so that put water out of our reach. Can't buy the water again. So you have plenty of farmers now where you might start out a crop, but he can't continue to water. So although this seems like a better option for farmers, the price fluctuations of water means that it also creates certain kinds of vulnerabilities. Thirdly, I mentioned at the outset in Hounslow in particular, some farmers had access to this underground irrigation system. This would also seem to be really a good thing for farmers, reduce a lot of their vulnerability. Except the model of farming that goes along with irrigation tends to also require more inputs of fertilizer, of chemicals. These are larger fields. They often require mechanization, so you have to hire a tractor. You might have to hire laborers to help you reap the crop. So there's an expense. There's a lot of capital expense involved in the model of farming that makes use of a big irrigation system as opposed to just hand watering every individual's crop. So here's a farmer says, chemical gone up, fertilizer gone up, and what you produce, no, it's going down. The tractor man who plows it go, the day laborers go, you producing a lot more, she admits. This is a female farmer, in fact. And you owe more money than before. You got to take out loans to buy this stuff. So the productivity is higher in a farm field that has this kind of irrigation, but because it requires more investment, at the end of the day, the farmer may not, in fact, be better off. So another example, the big farmer or the money farmer, you can go bigger. Or you can continue along the same track. But it affects the small farmer a lot with the increase in fertilizer, increase in the spray material, increase in the seed. So rich, capitalized farmers can maybe take advantage of a sprinkler system like this, but small farmers have a difficult time. This divide between wealthy farmers and small farmers is even greater in the fourth kind of agricultural system that we've identified that we really want to take a look at, and this is greenhouse farming. Remember I said some farmers are making contracts with Grace Kennedy to receive their crops, and then they go into this processing facility. Most of these farmers, Grace Kennedy requires them to have a greenhouse, and this is a new initiative. The government is providing loans for farmers to set up a greenhouse. Now, you might say, why do we need a greenhouse in Jamaica? It just allows you to very carefully control the growing conditions. It's not obviously because it gets too cold, the way we use greenhouses up here. But a lot of farmers are starting this kind of farming, and the government is really pushing it. So the government says, farmers need to start embracing technology. It requires a change in mindset. Farmers should view farming as a business. And here's some very interesting quotes about the kind of farming that the government wants to promote. As a nation, a government official told us, we have sold agriculture as something that is only for the marginalized, an activity that you do just to keep alive rather than create wealth. Demonstrate to a young person, he said, that you can be a farmer and drive an SUV and live up in the hills. That's a sermon in and of itself. They don't have to get their hands dirty if you have a greenhouse. He's far more attracted to agriculture, not only from the standpoint of the sexiness, you know, in terms of the greenhouse, but also the returns. Nobody's ever repelled by money. They gravitate to it. So in suburban Kingston, you've got wealthy lawyers and businessmen who are actually in their backyard investing capital and setting up these greenhouses, which are now beginning to compete with the small farmers in St. Elizabeth Parish who don't have the ability to buy this greenhouse technology. You can see how this works. There's drip irrigation systems. But the specific amount of fertilizer, there are computers that control the irrigation, that control fertilizer. You can get tons, I don't remember the number, but literally like tons of tomatoes out of one greenhouse crop like this. They're very, very productive. But then we're back to the glut on the market, and our farmers back in St. Elizabeth Parish have to compete with these highly capitalized farmers. So there's a real disjunction between the so-called serious farmer that requires a business entrepreneurial mindset and a lot of capital, and the traditional small farmer who's really struggling in areas like St. Elizabeth. Last couple of comments. They come in with the idea around here, that is Grace Kennedy, but it's not to benefit farmers. These contracts, this farmer told us, only benefit Grace Kennedy. They are offering a contract, one of the lowest prices, below the belt, they would call it in boxing. It's just not feasible for us. It can't work at our price. Right? It can maybe work if you have a greenhouse, but there's no way that the farmers are going to get a contract. The farmers that we're talking to are going to get a contract to be a part of this packing facility. It will be difficult for small farmers, another farmer said to us. In all things, smaller persons will also always be behind based on the fact that you don't have any capital to pump in right away. So the bottom line, I think, for us is that this idea of catching a crop is not just a matter of whether it happens to rain or not, or what the market happens to be doing today, but it also has to do with these different agricultural systems and what they make possible, and in particular around the question of water. So water is going to be our focus in the next phase of this research. So just to kind of conclude, I think we can see clearly that farmers in St. Elizabeth are experiencing this double exposure. They tell us that, yes, we both see climate change and we see changes in our market conditions. The ways that farmers respond to this is a really important dimension, which is why we want to include more interviews in our next phase of our project. There are links between climate change and market fluctuations, including this interesting notion where a hurricane might actually be perceived as a really good thing because it allows me to outcompete my fellow farmers. And then lastly, this is sort of phrased in the verbiage of actor network theory, but the farm level vulnerability is mediated by these different agricultural technologies or assemblages, which allow certain kinds of things to take place. They facilitate some farmers being more successful and other farmers being quite a bit less successful. And there we are. There's me, Doug, and Scott at the Appleton Rum Tour, which I highly recommend. So, thank you very much. And I know we're a little behind schedule, but I'm really happy to entertain any questions you might have.
I'd just like to say that I connect with the study that you're doing because I've seen a similar circumstance, or a similar situation back in Greece. Small farmers are quickly becoming an extinct breed because of that double exposure that you're speaking about. We had Hurricane Ali 2010, Hurricane Richard. Several small farmers were injured, and they lost probably like each of them was like 2 or 3 acres worth of crop. Large farmer, he lost like 1,000 acres. The small farmer is still out of business. He did not have the capital to start back his farm. The large farmer lost 1,000 crops. He's still there with more acres of land. So
Well, and you might say, you know, the government seems to be almost saying, well, maybe that's okay, right? Because the big farmer can take over. Maybe we don't need all these inefficient small farms, and we'll just let the big, capitalized, serious farmers take over. But then what happens to those people? And again, that goes back to the rural-urban migration question. I mean, rural livelihoods in the Caribbean and other places in the global south are important for other reasons than just output per acre, right? And if you say to everybody, you have, you know, no livelihood in the rural sector, you know, you're going to provide jobs for those people in the big capital city, right? Which already Kingston has more than a third of the population of Jamaica.
Small farming was like a way of life.
Exactly.
Now the small farmers can see that they have to sell land to the bigger land.
Right, and then so there's a whole set of social problems that emerges from that. You know, that unemployment goes up in the urban areas, and you know, the growth of informal settlements, and it, you know, that becomes a real challenge. And I think from a policy perspective, you're much better off providing a way for small farmers to stay on the land. And these farmers want to be on the land. They love their farming. I love my farming man. I remember this guy very clearly telling me this. It just, and with this one guy said, you know, they just get angry. He said, oh, I planted a crop of cabbage. It was lush, man. It was green, man. And then the rain just came and took it all. And it was, I mean, you could just feel like, it wasn't just even saying, like, I lost the money I invested. Yeah. It was like, my cabbages are gone. And it just was, there's something really important about that. And I think we need to find ways of letting those farmers remain viable.
Are there any efforts on the organic farm community climate change?
There is very interesting. Yeah, it's from a consumer perspective, I don't think there's a widespread understanding about organics among the typical, you know, Jamaican consumer, and this is mostly domestic, you know, crops. But there's one champion in particular up in Potsdam, has a big farm growing all kinds of organic things, organic herbs. He had like cilantro and basil and purple ruffles basil, and showing me all these different purple broccoli he was growing. Some of this he was marketing to high-end hotels who could use, like, we serve organic meals in our restaurant as a way to get tourists. That's actually a separate, very interesting issue, is the links between these agricultural areas and the tourist sector up on the North Coast. There are not as many links as you might think. A lot of the stuff that ends up in the hotels is being imported rather than being shipped, you know, an hour away in St. Elizabeth Parish. So
yeah,
this guy...
Yeah, outside market, there would be maybe the local people, they don't understand organic, the advantage of organic production yet, but in the market, outside the local, regional,
right,
and international market, that maybe might be wrong.
This guy's really pushing it, and there's a little resort town called Treasure Beach, which is a little bit sort of like a funky version of... like Montego Bay. It's not kind of big mass tourism, it's more local. And there are some local people, restaurateurs, that are really pushing organics. There's a little market that sells organic produce. It's a very small scale at the moment, from what I can see. But I think there's a potential there. And this one farmer is a real champion. He really believes in it. He's sure that the Jamaican public will pay a little bit more for produce that's organic, because he can convince them that it's safe, it's not full of chemicals, it's better for the environment. And I think, as you say, organic farming is also a little bit more resilient in the face of fluctuating weather conditions, because you're not so reliant on the inputs of fertilizer, the inputs of water. You're using, you know, mulching and other kinds of organic techniques. It's a really good style of farming in variable weather conditions. So it'll be interesting to see how that progresses.
They seem really competitive.
It's a really good question. I think it's a crucial question. It's one that I'm very interested in. My work from Mexico, which was more about migration, but also, you know, had to do with farming, there's much more collective farming going on. And part of my argument was that collective farming was a good thing and helped to mitigate the need for people to migrate to the U.S. In Jamaica, the farming seems to be very individualistic. Back in the 70s, Michael Manley was prime minister. They basically had a socialist government, and they set up these big government food farms, they were called. They worked cooperatively, and, you know, farmers were collectivists, and they were, you know, basically working for the government, but they weren't very successful. They weren't very productive. And the government is trying to get farmers to establish these associations and work together, if nothing else, as I said before, so that everybody doesn't grow peppers at the same time, right? So I think it's something that we're going to try to ask farmers about more. There seems to be something about the farming culture in this part of Jamaica, at least, that goes a little bit against working together. From my sort of theoretical and political perspective, I think cooperative, you know, working cooperatively is really the answer. I think this is where they kind of need to go in order to, I mean, if farmers band together, they could maybe buy a truck and share the truck, and then they're not dependent on the higglers, just as one example. So it's something that I'm going to pay a lot of attention to.